It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Peter. He's, of course, is too self-effacing, and he's too kind about me. So if you all have done this kind of session before with Peter and whoever he's brought in, then I know you know him, and you know that I speak the truth. So I'm really looking forward to today. And what I've done is I have some opening comments, very informal, because I'm assuming, since you're teachers, you might have actually read something, and that you might want to talk, and that we can go back and forth. So I do have things to lay out there, but I don't want it to be all lecture all the time. So I'll probably say more for this first session, and then we can have our back and forth. But by the time we get to the second session, I have to look at the schedule again. What is that, after our early lunch, right? I will say very little, and we can really go back and forth. So, Harry Truman. Harry Truman was what you would call an accidental president, and probably a lot of you have used that kind of language in your teaching. Was this a bad thing, necessarily? No, as it turns out. I have found that in my study of Truman, and I've been at this for years now, looking at Harry Truman, that I'm glad, in a way, that he was who he was at the time he was, and that he wasn't an intellectual, that he wasn't somebody who came burdened to the White House with all sorts of background that some of our other presidents have. Does this mean that he was stupid? No. Was he well-read? Yes. But especially at this moment, at this critical moment at the beginning of the Cold War, at the beginning of an epic struggle, at the beginning of something that, when I'm sure you're teaching, you're trying to convey what does the 20th century mean in so many ways. And students might get World War I and World War II easier because those are hot wars and there's a beginning and an end, and of course you've got your proximate and profound causes and all that kind of stuff. But the Cold War can be harder sometimes to explain. So I am now convinced that for whatever reason it happened, it was good that it was Truman and at that particular time. He was a student of history, of politics, and the Bible. And as you know, I'm sure many of you, he didn't go to college, but he was well-read and he kept reading. And if you ever go to Independence, Missouri, his hometown, you can look at his library in his home and you can see the books on the shelves, and they have an itemization of them there, and you can figure out which ones were Harry Truman's and which ones belonged to his wife, Bess, and you can see their reading habits and all that kind of stuff. But it is clear that, you know, he was a student throughout his life. He had good instincts. He was a veteran of World War I, senator from Missouri for 10 years, and he came to the presidency with a worldview, and it was one that was already defined. I mean, people will focus so much on him being unprepared and new and sudden and all that kind of stuff, and it's true in a lot of ways, but he did come to the White House, he came to the presidency with a defined worldview, on top of which he was prepared to act on that worldview. Truman was a proud and partisan Democrat, but he was also an independent thinker, and I think this comes out a lot in what we'll be discussing about his understanding of the Cold War, his approach to it, and what he ended up doing in terms of articulating the meaning of the Cold War and laying out the policies to fight the Cold War. So he inherited Roosevelt's presidency. And a lot of people said, well, that means he was just finishing out that presidency. But he gradually replaced everyone in the cabinet, with the exception of James Forrestal, who went on to become the first Secretary of Defense. And he was very strategic, really, about how he did that. He couldn't get rid of everybody right away. You know, he was somebody walking in the shadow of Franklin Roosevelt, right? I'm sure you've all heard that expression before, read the books that use that expression. But he was able to figure out, what do I want and how am I going to set up the people around me so that I get the best advisors that I can get. And still, you know, he was looking at what was going on politically around him, to have really good people around him, not necessarily agreeing with all of them. He was an independent thinker. So I think he showed this right away in how he expressed himself when it came to the Soviet Union. And we'll talk about that more, obviously, all day. Since he did inherit a presidency, why not keep going with Franklin Roosevelt's approach? Truman ended up differing from his two great Democratic Party predecessors, Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. And this is truly amazing when you think about it, given that he had a relationship of sorts with both of them. As you know, he was a veteran of World War I. So under World War I, he had actually, you know, fought. He had served under Woodrow Wilson. He didn't know him personally. It wasn't like he was hanging out with him. But he knew him in a way that others wouldn't, right, when he came to the presidency. So he had admired Wilson. He knew that he was this great leader of the party, leader of the country. But he was able to decide, what do I agree with in Woodrow Wilson and what do I disagree with? And, you know, I have my own mind and I'm going to do what I want to do. The same is even truer of Franklin Roosevelt. Here he actually had also a personal relationship. I mean, you know, really direct, knew him, right? And what I have found interesting is how he was able to say, okay, Franklin Roosevelt was a great leader, getting us out of the Depression, wartime leader, all this sort of stuff. But you know, he had these flaws. He had this ego. He thought he could do everything. And I'm not going to take that from him when I'm president. I'm not going to borrow that or carry that on. And as we will see, it also spills over into substance. He doesn't agree with all of Franklin Roosevelt's sort of political and philosophical approach either. And I think some of it with Roosevelt is also the fact that when he was senator and he was the head of what became known as the Truman Committee, and he was really looking at how are we conducting the war, and he was able to keep the big picture, but he was also nitty-gritty about here's what we're going to do, here's what we're going to do, here's what we're going to do. He started to realize that he could do things like that, and that he didn't have to necessarily agree with what had preceded him. So, as I'm saying, he came to office and he was really an independent thinker. We know we use archetypes sometimes in teaching. Woodrow Wilson is somebody who ends up being an idealist, right? Now, there's a whole argument about what idealism means, and can you call Wilson a pure idealist, blah, blah, blah. You know, how are we going to get into philosophy to explain it all? But he is an idealist, setting aside all the debates we could have, on specific points, on the fact that for Wilson, if you could set up the international system right, if you could just get that system right, then that would mean that you'd have everything right for the states involved and the individuals involved in that system. So he's a top-down kind of guy. International meant universal for him. He wanted the International Organization of the League of Nations to become a permanent institution. And he really was a proponent of what one scholar calls progressive internationalism. And I think that's one of the best ways to describe Wilson. When it comes to his understanding of international relations and what the United States should be doing in the world. So what this meant for him is that peace was the fulfillment of progressive history, of this inevitably unfolding history, and Wilson had been put in place you know, at that time to help make that happen, and he consciously thought of himself that way. So did it mean that states weren't important? No, states were very important, nation states were very important, and you know this also from the domestic side of things, what he was trying to do. But he was trying to set up a progressive administrative state, and in a sense this was replacing, he hoped, what Truman, we'll see, would call the regime, and what would really be the liberal regime. So internationally he was so focused on the structure of the system. And he thought that this would lead then to peace, and that peace was inevitable if everything was structured right. What this also meant was that then peace would have a definition where justice came first. If he could set everything up right according to his terms of justice, then you would have freedom flow from that and order flow from that, and you'd end up with a peace. One of the fatal flaws in this approach is that Wilson presumed moderation on the part of those he was dealing with, the states that he was dealing with, the other world leaders he was dealing with. And as we'll see, this is problematic. I mean, you see it in the interwar period, you see it in World War II, and you see it with the rise of the Soviet Union, too. Now let's look at another big archetype, Franklin Roosevelt. He is often called a realist, right? Realism. So power politics, concerned about how you're going to do that balance of power, whereas the idealist believes that man can be good or can be made to be good, the realist is saying, okay, well, man's pretty much lost cause. We need to have everything correctly set up to mitigate the fact that he's self-interested or maybe even, nasty, downright nasty. And in terms of the international system, the realist is very focused on the state level, the nation-state level. And if you get all the different states interacting correctly, then you end up with, an okay system, at least one characterized by stability, but you're really focused on that state level. And things will be okay, things will be as good as they can be, stable and peaceful in the way a realist means it at the individual level. So for Franklin Roosevelt, international meant that you would have the United Nations legitimating decisions that were made by the great powers, the four policemen, in what he was seeing as an increasingly interdependent world. So he did want spheres of influence, all this stuff that people commonly say about Franklin Roosevelt. And he thought that this was because he too wanted peace. I mean, they all wanted peace, right? But it's how do you get to it? How do you define it? How do you reach it? So with Franklin Roosevelt, people wanted peace too. He wanted peace. But order or stability was most important to him. So you're changing from where you were with Wilson. And this order, this stability was the primary ingredient of the peace. Then you'd have your freedom, then you'd have your justice. All of this would lead you to peace. So Roosevelt also, as it turns out in a flaw, presumed moderation on the part of different states. He thought that through his personal diplomacy, and if you set up the structure right in terms of how you would have the spheres of influence and the four policemen and divide your world and all of that, you could go ahead and have a stable and thus peaceful world. Truman, by contrast, he's not idealist or realist. He started with basic principles that he thought were American. He also believed them to be true, right? He didn't think they were just specifically American. So he's a big freedom and equality kind of guy. I mean, if you look at him, is he exactly like the American founders? No. But is he more in that tradition than what you get with Wilson? Absolutely. He's into this more basic understanding of freedom and equality. Freedom becomes essential for Truman for all of international relations and also for the individual and also for the proper context in which you would have your state, your government, your regime. For him, there could be no ethical action without this necessary precondition of freedom. So Truman ends up being much different and... piece of paper out of order, of course. So Truman based his understanding of politics then on what you would call regime distinctions, really understanding what's the difference between government, how they're set up, their meaning, their fundamental purpose. And in his Truman Doctrine speech, which I think was one of the things I asked for you all to be able to read, you really see this. Here's how he described the Cold War as a choice between stark alternatives. One way of life is based upon the will of the majority and is distinguished by free institutions, representative government, free elections, guarantees of individual liberty, freedom of speech and religion, and freedom from political oppression. And then by contrast, the second way of life is based upon the will of the minority, forcibly imposed upon the majority, and then paraphrasing, relies on terror and oppression and negating free will and choice. And in grounding his conception of what he saw as the universal reality about freedom in this nature of regimes, Truman ended up solving kind of a problem that's in Wilson and Roosevelt, and also doing something that was very American. He rejected the moral equivalence of the democratic and communist regimes. So that's his entire setup for how he's going to fight the Cold War. And I would argue that this point is crucial to understanding about Truman. The question of the regime was at the heart of everything he did in international politics. And the Standard places him in the company more with the American founders, with Tocqueville, with Lincoln, with other giants that we might talk about in U.S. history. And it sets him apart from Wilson and from Roosevelt. The Cold War, then, is something that you see this play out in. And Truman uses this understanding of freedom, this understanding of what he's seeing as the stark alternatives in the Cold War, as the entire way for him to ground his strategy of containment. He really saw the Cold War as a conflict between good and evil, between freedom and tyranny, between liberal democracy and totalitarianism, and between capitalism and communism. He did see it that way. Did he think we were perfect? No. But he thought that the United States and its allies were more on the right side, and that they were espousing something and acting on something that was on the side of the good and the true, and the free, of course. So his basic Cold War strategy was an aim to thwart the future gains that the Soviets would be trying to do, to stimulate free and just governments, protect them where they were, stimulate them where they could be, and then over time to actually frustrate, as the language becomes in NSC 68, which we'll talk about much later, frustrate the Kremlin design. And this meant actually making the Soviet Union change. He did have that as a goal in containment. So to return to the more practical, Truman then could surround himself with experienced and capable advisors, but he was confident about his core principles. He accepted advice and counsel, but his final decisions about how to frame the approach to the Cold War and how to fight the Cold War were his own. And did all of this happen overnight? No. Did Truman refine his understanding of the Cold War and how to approach it over time? Yes. And aren't we happy about that? I mean, would you want somebody to only be fighting whatever struggle he's in, you know, as president the same way the whole time and not be able to understand what's going on and not be able to gain more understanding of it? No. But he always had this basic understanding of the Cold War. And I would actually point to a key example here which might be helpful with respect to the United Nations. Like Republicans and Democrats at that time, you know, anybody who was an internationalist at that time, Truman wanted the United Nations to succeed. He wanted it to be a going concern. He wanted it, you know, to be something where the nations of the world would come together and have a forum and be able to communicate and, you know, enlarge the prospects for peace and all of these noble goals. But he realized that the Cold War did something to the United Nations, that it subverted it, that it, you know, the Soviet Union was subverting the intent of the United Nations. And so it's fascinating to go through especially the years like 45. I mean, you know, you see it even into the early 50s, but going from 1945, when Truman becomes president, up to about 48, 49, it's fascinating to see how Truman, on the one hand, still wants it to be the UN. On the other hand, though, he's like, well, but that's getting in the way of, you know, these basic principles, especially freedom, and I want to have a peaceful world, but it has to mean something. I have to define it. I have to, you know, here's what I want to do. We've got the Soviet Union doing all of these things. So if you're looking for sort of a mini case study of how a statesman comes to, you know, apply his principles and see how that might mean changing his attitude about something that he held dearly, you know, that was a practical thing, not a, you know, a theoretical thing. This attitude toward the United Nations is fascinating with Truman, this changing attitude with him. So he refined his understanding of the Cold War over time without changing the basic principles that he brought to his understanding of the Cold War. And he grew to understand the circumstances better and better as he grew in his presidency. And in short, I would say he was prudent. So with that as introduction, I thought we could now go to some of the questions I raised for session one, but also whatever you all feel like talking about. Although I suppose in this morning session, we should try to confine ourselves to Truman's early presidency and the basic building blocks of containment, like the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and NATO. And leave some of the other questions for later. But I'm fine if we start jumping around a little bit. If I think we're really getting too far afield, I'll rein us back in. And then I just want to make sure that we're going for about an hour now, I think it is, until lunch. So let's go ahead and start. Yes?
How much the Truman Doctrine was the George Kennan Doctrine?
It's great. George Kennan. George Kennan is important to containment. I'm going to back up and we'll get to this, the Truman Doctrine itself. He's important to containment, but he's not the one who crafted it or was the architect of it. He wrote the Long Telegram from Moscow in 1946. This was an important document. It's something that, you know, students should read. If they don't get to it in high school, then they should read it in college if they're doing something, you know, that has to do with the 20th century and foreign policy. It affected a lot of those around Truman, but it didn't change his mind about things. And also, I think you may have read the part about the Long Telegram that I wrote on. I would also argue that in a fundamental way, the Long Telegram is not the kind of containment then that Truman was setting up. The same is true of Kennan's other famous paper, the X Article of 1947. You're seeing now a much more fuller expression of what the realist understanding of the Cold War would be in terms of it being a struggle for power, that kind of thing, that you really shouldn't worry so much about the internal differences between the two states, that you should focus more on the behavior of the Soviet Union. All of this comes out in the X article. And in that, he calls for a long-term patient vigilance and containment of the Soviet Union. That's where that comes out in the X article. Kennan comes back to the United States. He had been abroad for over 20 years, with I think only 1 year back in the United States during that time. He comes back to the United States after the Long Telegram, and he becomes the first director of the policy planning staff at the State Department. And so in 1947, he is there at the time of the Truman Doctrine. He is not happy. He does not like what Truman is talking about doing. He thinks it's universalistic. Not universal, but universalistic, right? He thinks that it's blowing things out of proportion, that it's opening a can of worms in terms of policy, How is it going to be applied? You know, if this means this for Greece and Turkey, then let's make it only narrowly confined that this language and Truman's speech, all of this he objected to. And he wrote and spoke on that. It was to private audiences often, you know, like at the Naval War College or sort of government and defense institutions. But he was very clear that he did not approve of this. And this gets us into the attitude that a lot of people had at the time about the Truman Doctrine. You know, here was Truman saying, okay, we are in extraordinary circumstances. We are having to commit ourselves to the world as we never have before. We're going to need to do this thing, and it becomes known as the Truman Doctrine very quickly. And it may specifically be about aid to Greece and Turkey right now, you know, military and strategic and economic aid. But this is talking about that you know, the two ways of life and the struggle and the alternatives that we face. That's what the Truman Doctrine is about. So he's had to galvanize public opinion. He's had to turn people around after fighting World War II. And okay, now we're in this big struggle. And I know you can't see it in the same way that you saw World War II, but it's there and it's real. And you have a response from realists, and Kennan's one of them. Arthur Schlesinger, who becomes very important to the formation of the ADA, the Americans for Democratic Action. Others at the time too, but they start making this critique of Truman and of the Truman Doctrine for being immoderate, or being for exaggerating the threat. And as a result, they want to ignore it. First, they want to, you know, stop it if they can, and Kennan actually, you know, tried. And he said, well, at least Turkey shouldn't be included. Only do Greece. If you have to do it, you know, don't do Turkey. But when he couldn't succeed on that, he and others at the time who were critical, they wanted to define the Truman Doctrine out of containment. And that's why when the Marshall Plan comes along, they are so excited about the Marshall Plan. I mean, they think the Marshall Plan is necessary, but they think that you can use the Marshall Plan as something to show what a good kind of containment would be. Yes?
It just seemed to me that with Wilson's missionary diplomacy and his commitment to democracy, which carried over to his relationships with all countries, that certainly he evidenced this, a very similar sense of right and wrong that I think, if I'm getting correct, if I'm understanding correctly, you see in Truman. I mean,
right. He had a sense of right and wrong, absolutely. I think the distinction that one should draw between Wilson and Truman is that Wilson thought that all of this was inevitable, that it was unfolding, you know, that sort of democracy and progress were the wave of the future. You couldn't stop it, you shouldn't stop it. He, as a statesman, could see this and help direct it. And yes, he spoke in moral terms. Truman, by contrast, didn't think it was inevitable that you could have freedom and democracy. He thought they were most important, but he thought that you had to fight for them. He thought that you had to set up policies and institutions that would preserve them and promote them and defend them. And he did not place his confidence in structuring the world in a way that Wilson did. Truman said, okay, well, it's more important to me that there are free peoples and free institutions and free governments. And for Wilson, he would talk about democracy, right? And he would say self-determination and work out your own destinies and all that kind of stuff. But he was still very focused on, if I can structure this whole world the right way with the League of Nations, everything will fall into place with states under it. I think that's a big difference between them in their views of international relations? And does it mean, you know, somebody who's not an idealist can still express ideals, right? But Truman didn't have the ism of it. He wasn't Wilsonian, even though he was still a proponent of freedom and democracy. And part of that, I think, is because he was still always very much grounded in, you know, what's the individual makeup of all of these different states? Yes?
You were talking about how some of his early experiences helped shape who he was, and one of the things I'd like for you to expand on is his experiences in World War I and how that impacted how he saw the world, and later on how he saw the Soviet aggression in Europe.
Right.
I mean, because he lives through essentially both world wars.
Right, right. I do think this is important to understanding Truman. Well, first of all, because he had read as a child and he'd read sort of great history, and you know, he was enamored of heroes and statesmen and all this stuff. I mean, you know, it was a classical education, right? So he had all of that going into World War I. And he really wanted to serve in World War I. He thought that, you know, the public part of Wilson, the part about, you know, we are going to make the world safe for democracy, all that stuff, he wanted to serve in World War I. He, you know, as you probably know, he wore glasses, he had bad eyesight. He was really, I mean, devious in how he got around things and got into, I mean, he'd already been in the reserves, but how he got into, or the National Guard, how he got into the Army to be on active duty and then to be a captain in World War I. So he gets over to France, and he writes letters to Bess, who will become his wife. Bess Wallace and he had known each other, you know, since they were very little. And he probably is the most revealing in that correspondence about what World War I means to him and how it's affecting him. And so he's still talking about the larger meaning of World War I and why we're here and why we're fighting. But he also quickly is experiencing what it is to be, you know, in battle, to be leading men because he's a captain, to be experiencing, you know, the day-to-day grind of doing this kind of stuff. And so he does have an appreciation for war and that, you know, you really have to be fighting it for the right reasons. And so he starts writing very critical things from time to time about Wilson and saying, you know, Wilson doesn't get this, Wilson doesn't get that to Beth. And so with Truman, you know, he'll have these big ideas. He does have big ideas, but there's always something very practical, very rooted for him. And I think the actual experiences of World War I have a lot to do with that. So at a certain point, you know, he wants to just get home. He let's finish this up and let's get home. But he's dedicated and remains true. And his men were very loyal. I mean, they would come and march with him every year of his presidency. He kept up with a number of them. Any of them that wrote him, he wrote them back. You can read the correspondence. They were loyal, and I think that shows that he must have been a good leader, too, because we don't have all sorts of documentary evidence about what he was doing minute by minute with the soldiers under him. But I think this was something that helped prepare him too in terms of leadership, right? And he was also a little bit older. You know, he's already in his 30s when he goes off to World War I. And I don't know if you call Truman a late bloomer. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of he was failing in business and the haberdasher kind of view of Truman. I have come to see him as somebody who took family responsibilities and duty to country very seriously. And so a lot of that period of time where he knew he wanted to marry Bess way early, I mean, he says it was as soon as he saw her in Sunday school, right, when he was 5 and she was 4, whatever they were. It's really cute. But he knew. And so some of this was he wanted to have prospects and be able to provide for her, but also he was helping to run his family farm. He was helping and there were all sorts of health issues with his father. He was doing all of these sorts of things. Then he was trying the business efforts. And then you have World War I on top of that. So he was somebody who had been, you know, experiencing, you know, not only duty to family, but doing different business efforts, both in farming and in, you know, town businesses. Then he has the World War I experience. And then he comes home, finally, after World War I. And so he's matured. He's got his view now of what the world's like. He's actually been abroad, like a lot of people at his time hadn't been able to do. For somebody without a college education to have that kind of experience, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it does, I mean, he obviously had something in him that wanted to serve, that wanted to go to war. So he had, I don't know if you'd call it ambition, he wanted to be tested, he wanted to do this. But he has more direction even after he comes back from World War I. I mean, we can keep, you can ask more on that. But we can keep going back. Yes?
From what you said a few minutes ago, would it be safe to say that George Kennan resented this accidental upstart president? Did he also resent George Marshall when he became Secretary of State?
That Kennan did?
Yes.
Yeah. I think Kennan didn't care for Truman. I mean, I think that's clear from what you find.
But an upstart?
Yeah, I think Kennan would say, you know, you should have somebody who's more experienced in an establishment kind of way, somebody who went to the right school, somebody who, I mean, he was an elitist. And what Kennan never connected with on Truman is that Truman really was a man of the people. I mean, he, you know, he became president, but he didn't forget where he came from. He went back to where he came from. Different kind of guys. I mean, even though they both came from the Midwest, I mean, different parts of the Midwest. And Kennan, Kennan was an intellectual on top of everything else. And I don't know if I say resent, but he certainly didn't care for...
Did he want to be Secretary of State?
Did he want to be Secretary of State? He probably thought he should be Secretary of State at some point, but I've never seen him write anything where he resented Marshall becoming Secretary of State. I haven't seen that. He worked well with Marshall. Marshall picked him, handpicked him. Marshall let him run a lot of things. I mean, so many of the policy things that came out were I mean, Kennan was very proprietorial about everything he wrote, and He would go through drafts over and over again. He would rewrite other people. He wanted every word to be just so. And Marshall largely supported him in all of that. And also, Marshall, I mean, military man, as you know, great leader. But he, if you were going to talk about what sort of archetype he was more realist than anything else. So he agreed with a lot of what Kennan was writing for. Yes?
In terms of understanding of communism as a philosophy, who understands it best? Truman, Marshall, Kennan, none of them? And, secondly, can any of them effectively separate their vision of Joseph Stalin and some of his shenanigans from the philosophy? How much of it is very personal?
Truman would have, you know, probably read whatever anybody else read in history about Marx, about the theory of communism. But what really stuck in his craw was tyranny, right? He didn't like tyrants. He hated the Nazis. He hated the communists. So he saw World War II, right? He saw what was happening there. He made more than one comment about how if they could just go both kill each other, wouldn't that be great? And this would solve the problem, right? We get rid of a whole bunch of nasty people. You know, he's writing best saying, well, you know, we're getting rid of the Nazis now, but we're still going to have to deal with the Russians and the Chinese after World War II. And these are his sensibilities, right? So is he sitting around thinking about dialectical materialism? Is he thinking about, you know, sitting around, you know, do I need to read the lesser texts of Marx as well as Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto? No. But was it communism that he thought we were facing? Yes. I mean, it was totalitarianism. It was communism. It was communism as it was put into practice, and that's what was in front of him, right? It wasn't, you know, the theory of communism. He has a couple of comments at one point in some of his... He didn't keep a daily diary. He wrote... but he has lots of longhand notes throughout the years. So anyway, he has a couple of comments where he says, if you could do communism exactly like you have it in the Bible, in terms of like everybody equally sharing and Jesus is God, you know, is reigning, right? Then maybe, right? Then it would be, that's the way it's supposed to be. But how it was put into practice and what happened, and that would mean he wouldn't even approve of the, you know, the Marx version of it, the Marxist version of it. So that's Truman. And he had his ideas, but he was very practical about how to face it. Marshall, I don't know. I mean, I've been to the Marshall Library, but I haven't seen his letters or his writings on communism as a theory. He initially thought that you could negotiate more with the Soviets, that you could figure out a way to get things to be stable enough. But then he goes to one of the Council on Foreign Ministers meetings in spring 1947, and he really has one-on-one interactions with his Soviet counterparts. And they're talking about how, you know, even when he's sort of willing to give a little, they just want more and more and more and more. And he finally says, you know, that's it. And so he comes back to the States, and he gives this this radio address that... affects everyone and makes them realize that the people around him, that Marshall has sort of shifted now in his understanding of the Cold War and sees the Soviets as a real threat. And his working relationship with those who were sort of more Cold Warrior-like in the administration improves after that, because he's changed. I mean, he changes in his view. Does he ever use all of the kind of language that Truman uses? No. He was a sober Secretary of State. I wouldn't call him a team player, but he didn't put himself forward, but he knew that people esteemed him. And Truman called him the great one of the age, even while Franklin Roosevelt was living. He finally came to see communism as a problem, and that the Cold War was this, you know, great struggle and this challenge, and that we had to do things. And it's in that context that you get the Marshall Plan for Marshall. So it was Truman, Marshall, and then Kennan. Kennan, of course, had read all the theories, right? He had lived it. He knew Russian. He had been, you know, all over, not just in Soviet Union. For his State Department Foreign Service, he had been, you know, detained by the Nazis at one point. I mean, you know, he wasn't pro-tyranny. Don't get me wrong; it's not like he was for it. But he thought, this is a huge country, a big nation state with a powerful leader, lots of troops, lots at its disposal, willing to put everything into, taking over and oppressing. We're not going to be able to change that. What we should be concerned about is their external behavior, and if it affects us too much, what are we going to do in response? But we're going to sort of, you know, put this line down and not worry about, I mean, observe, write about it, explain it to my superiors, which he was doing, but not think that we can fundamentally change the Soviets, the communism that they put into practice. He thought they were using the theory of communism as a fig leaf for what was really a power drive, you know, and that they were, you know, some of them might believe, but the ones who were in charge, Stalin, you know, all this sort of stuff, that really this was the fig leaf that would cover up that they were just like any other hegemon in the past who was trying for power. Yes?
Actually, I have two areas that this, you know, we're talking about his early presidency. One is the Chinese Civil War and reading that or misreading that. And one of the most significant efforts on the part of the United Nations early on, the partition of Palestine, and how Truman's perception of freedom played out in that event.
Right. China. It's so hard. I always try to put myself back then. I mean, this, and when I'm talking with my students, I do that too. Because we have to remember how there was so much going on in a very short period of time. And I know you all know it because you're teaching. But, you know, I will even remind myself over and over again, oh my gosh, you know, World War II is still going on. You've got all this stuff going on in China for years and years and years, long before World War II. You've got everything going on in Europe, elsewhere in the Pacific. You know, everything is going on. So Truman looks at China, and he listens to Secretary of State Marshall, who at that point is not Secretary of State. This is when he sends Marshall. Marshall's, you know, finished his World War II duty and wants to get out of government, or, you know, out of service. And Truman says, I need you again. I want you to go to China. So Marshall heads up this this mission to China to fact find and to figure out in the immediate post-war period what's going on in China and what should we do and whom should we support. And Marshall doesn't like anybody. He doesn't like the choices, right? So he doesn't like the communists, but he also doesn't like Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. And he thinks that the ones that are more moderate are the weakest and they're not going to be able to prevail. So it's sort of like a pox on both the communists and the nationalists. And he tells this to Truman. And Truman doesn't know Asia as well as he knows Europe. And I would argue, as we'll get to with the Middle East, as well as he ends up knowing the Middle East. And so I'm not saying he sets aside China, but it's not as much of a priority in that post-war period to 1949, when you have the fall of China.
What input did either Marshall or Truman solicit from Joe Stilwell?
I don't know. I don't think Truman, I don't think, you know, it got up to that point. Marshall would have had some back and forth with him. I have not gone through the documentary stuff on that at the Marshall Library. Marshall relies very much on his own experiences there. Anyway, you get to 1949, and, you know, China is falling, and critics of the Truman administration are accusing Truman and Dean Acheson of losing China, you know, all this kind of stuff. But all that said, Truman writes privately about deploring the Chinese communists and about how they're not good and he doesn't want them, and that after you can, you know, you have to deal with the Soviet Union, that's the primary threat, but we're also going to have to deal with China. And he is firm about not recognizing diplomatically China when the People's Republic of China is established. Truman may not be able to go in to stop it, but he says we're not going to diplomatically recognize the People's Republic of China. And so he does that, and then when you get to the Korean War, he also sends a fleet to make sure that Taiwan, the Republic of China, is protected, because we do have archival information now from various sources that shows that, you know, China was thinking, great, now the United States and others are occupied in Korea, let's go ahead and get Taiwan right now. So he does that. So that's China. I mean, you know, huge topic. Obviously, that's a quick take on it. But you can read some of his own words about it, and you can see his frustration and his understanding of the Cold War at that point as something where China was part of this totalitarian threat, but the Soviets were the primary part, the one that you really had to keep your eye on. Palestine, Israel. Truman was very much alone in his administration when it came to partition of Palestine and the formation of the new state of Israel. He did have the support of his special counsel, Clark Clifford, sort of, you know, another one of these wise men who's not always up in the top tier of wise men, along with Acheson and Marshall, and you know, sometimes Kennan gets put up in that top tier, but Clark Clifford was definitely right up there, and he had been very instrumental at various points along the way to Truman. Truman came to trust him. I think in the way that Truman came to trust Acheson, because Acheson was always loyal. Truman also came to trust Clifford because Clifford was loyal in the same sort of way. Clark Clifford also, though, believed that it would be good to have the new state of Israel. But them aside, I mean, everybody was against the new state of Israel, didn't want Truman to be handling things as he was doing. I think I write it in the book. There's this amazing encounter between Truman and George Marshall, where Marshall, I mean, you know, this is a man who said, don't even call me bipartisan, call me nonpartisan, right? This was a military man who was trying to remain so much above politics. So anyway, they're in this meeting, and he says, you cannot do what you're doing with respect to Palestine. There shouldn't be this new state of Israel. You know, if I were to vote in the next election, I would not vote for you. I mean, he's saying this to the president. Okay, granted, he's, you know, he's George Marshall, but he's not the president, right? And Truman is there, and he's, you know, he's taking it, but he did not budge. He does not change his mind. So why? Why? Why is he so staunch on this? Why is he so firm on this? There are several reasons. Yes, Truman looked at the geography of the matter. I think when he looked at the Middle East, it's very interesting. Truman would frequently pull out a map to explain the Middle East. There's this, you know, the famous example is when Dwight Eisenhower is saying, you know, do you understand what we're getting into with respect to something? And Truman pulls out a map and starts, you know, explaining things, and people in the room said it was a well-worn map. I mean, you know, this kind of thing. So that's that. But he would look at the geography of the matter. He thought that the Balfour Declaration and the agreements out of World War I should be honored. This meant that there was supposed to be a state at some point, and that this was the time for it. So he looked at the geography. He looked at the diplomatic history. He looked at the political history, too. He was motivated also by the issue of displaced persons. He would say there were a lot of displaced persons from World War II, and it's, you know, there was a significant percentage that was Jewish. So he said there should be a homeland for them. I mean, he would talk that way. And then I think the way that you really want to tie it all up for Truman is he did look at it in religious terms. I mean, he was a Baptist. He had friends who were Jews. He got frustrated with some of his friends. I mean, if they got too Zionist on him, he said, don't you realize I'm dealing with people who are, you know, really Zionist, but I'm also dealing with these pro-Arabs, and I'm also dealing with these people who don't want anything. I mean, you know, he would get frustrated with all of that. But he was tacking a very definite course, wanting to support a homeland for the Jewish people. So his foundation in that was really very biblical.
I find it interesting that frequently the Balfour Declaration, etc., you know, are mentioned by scholars, but Truman's role is usually absent.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's quite significant.
Yes, yeah. And he was president at the time. it is quite significant. A passage from Deuteronomy that he would sometimes quote, even in meetings, you know, with advisors, was, behold, I have given up the land before you. Go in and take possession of the land which the Lord hath sworn unto your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So it was really the confluence of what was historical, what was moral, what was religious, what was, I mean, strategic, too. He did have strategic concerns. But all of it was coming together for him with respect to that. I think you can't separate that out, and I think part of the reason that sometimes Truman is ignored in all of that is because people have not looked at his religious beliefs, too. Yes?
Going backwards from that, but with that theme, am I correct in understanding that perhaps the biggest difference between Truman's construction of anything he did, but especially referring to the differences between himself and Wilson, is that Wilson framed his concepts on an intellectual academic understanding and model, whereas Truman filtered everything that he intellectually modeled through his Judeo-Christian beliefs?
Did everybody hear that? No. I think that's a great way of putting it, and it's largely how I would put it. But also, you cannot omit Wilson's own religious views.
That's what I'm saying. I know Wilson was a
Presbyterian believer.
I know he was a believer.
Right.
But it seems like as long as it wasn't in a direct conflict, he didn't model necessarily as much through his religious beliefs as he modeled through his academic understanding.
Constructs. Right, exactly.
And whereas I see Truman as filtering everything he does through his understanding of the Bible.
Right, and for Truman, it becomes something that they're not in tension with each other. The political and the religious go together. They reinforce each other. They're not at odds with each other. Could he still be political? Yes. Could he still, make calculations about things? Yes. But you cannot take out his religious beliefs from his statesmanship, from what he was doing. You can't take them out either for Wilson, but they're differently involved with his entire political understanding of things. And I do think that as much as he was a believer, that perhaps the intellectual part ends up eclipsing kind of the heart part. And I'm not saying, Truman wasn't mushy. He wasn't like, okay, let's just go follow my heart now. But he was, it was together. It was all in sync. That makes sense. Yes?
I have three questions for you.
Sure. You want to ask them one at a time?
if you'd like. I grew up in Greece most of my life, and we would always not walk by the Harry Truman statue because it was always the most blown-up statue. The Greeks have the following problem with the Truman Doctrine. Number one, the fact that it's called a doctrine by itself implies that it's imposing its will on people. Number two, the fact, what were they thinking when they included Turkey in this aid? Mortal enemy, and Turkey had never raised a weapon to hit the Allies ever in any world conflict. And number three, at the end, he mentions that this is an investment. So that as an investment, the people in these countries don't really matter. So that's my first question.
Okay. And you're supposed to be done by 2 o'clock.
I only bring it up because here in America, we don't, it's perceived in the world that we don't often study our history and act according to the sensitivities of particular countries.
Right. Well, on the last part first, I think if you look at the entire Truman Doctrine speech, the whole speech, that the investment part can be seen in a much broader context, and it shouldn't be perceived that way. I think, and you all have it. You have the speech. You can read it. It's not just about investment. But he's a practical man. It is also an investment. But we were investing in, post-war Japan. We were investing in, trying to, help Germany become Germany and maybe, help at least preserve the western part of it. So we were doing that kind of investment elsewhere. So in terms of the whole doctrine part, it wasn't called the Truman Doctrine initially. I mean, it was within days in the press it was being called the Truman Doctrine. that reflects, I mean, that does reflect the American side in that this was a bold announcement of something new. This was involving us in the world in a way we had never been before. Experts and the press and you know, people within government too, and part of what scared Kennan et al. Was that they could see, you know, boy, we had the Monroe Doctrine, and then we had a long period, and there were some corollaries and things like that. But whoa, now we've got a doctrine. You know, this is new. This is bold. This is different. This is how we're going to fight the Cold War. So I can understand that the people in the region might object to the word doctrine, but it's not something that Truman picked, and he would always say, you know, I don't really like the name of that. And if you read his private writings, you know, he wasn't keen on that. But part of it was to show the gravity and depth of commitment on the part of the United States. And I don't know if that would have, you know, if it had been spun that way more, I don't know if the statue would have been blown up less, but
they're still blowing it
up. Right.
Maybe it's just bad art.
It's very stately.
Okay, stately. All right. That doesn't. We can't. That was a nice try. But the region overall, Truman looked at the Middle East and the Near East as the gateway between East and West. I mean, he really thought. You know, Greece and Turkey were so essential to what was going on in the East and what was going on in the West. And again, you know, strategy was very important to him here. So there was talk of leaving out Turkey, and Kennan, for one, was a big proponent of it. But there was already a lot of Soviet pressure and communist pressure on Turkey. And Truman, Acheson worked with him very closely on the Truman Doctrine. But Truman really said, no, this has to be about both. He was concerned, I mean, you know, Greece was further along in terms of what he would like in developing a freer, more open regime, you know, that it was on some sort of path that he could see could end up in a good direction. He knew Turkey was nowhere near that, but he could see that if you let Turkey go communist, then you wouldn't have had anything to work with. Yes,
it's great.
Exactly.
How can you contain the Soviets if you don't have control of the Bosphorus and the
We should have a map. We should have a map
and
in here.
If you got it, you cut Russia's
exactly.
Russia. And Russia wanted a warm weather port, and that goes way back.
Exactly. So I mean, strategy and geography are really important here.
Always a weak country is put in there or allowed to be in there. You know, I think it even gets back to Bismarck. Just allow a weak power to control that because there's. You know, it would upset the balance of power if a major power controlled the Bosphorus and Dardanelles.
Right.
Well, that brings me to that. My other question. If, I guess it's kind of simplistic. Would you consider, well, two things. How close, based on your research of Truman and his belief that communism was as bad as Nazism, and the fact that we had, what was it, 12, 13 million men in uniform, and that we had the bomb, did we come close to using or consider using the bomb against this new enemy? And the more simplistic question, and I don't know if you can go one way or another with it, is was he a dove or a hawk?
That's not a simplistic question. It's not a simplistic question. Okay, I'll come back to that one. The bomb... even in the depths of him writing about, you know, after the Soviets successfully test their own atomic bomb, you know, things seem to be crumbling around us. China is falling. Korea is starting. He's found out, you know, even more problems with what's going on inside the Eastern Bloc. He doesn't talk about bombing the Soviet Union. He had a healthy respect for the downside of the technological advancements in terms of atomic weaponry. As you know, he dropped, you know, he ordered the dropping of two bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Atomic bombs then were not what nuclear weapons are now, but they were big, they were powerful. Did he think it was important that we developed atomic weaponry? Yes. When he realized that the Soviets had successfully tested their atomic bomb earlier than expected from all intelligence estimates, and he realized, you know, from our intelligence that they were starting even to try to work on the hydrogen bomb, that's when he orders, you know, to proceed on developing the hydrogen bomb. So it's acting from strength. It's, you know, we cannot remove this piece from our arsenal. They've got it. And the problem as to why they have it is because they're a totalitarian, nasty regime with totalitarian, nasty leaders. He was briefly interested in the Baruch plan and some of that kind of stuff, but he quickly realized that that wouldn't be the way to go. I don't think he would have... I don't think he would have ordered... I mean, nothing I've seen makes it sound like he would have ordered dropping a bomb on Moscow or somewhere else, even though he would have liked to have changed things.
I assume there was a lot of pressure on by various elements.
Well, from time to time, yeah, sure, there were. He had some critics who were more... who wanted more done at certain points, right? So some of them might have said from time to time that we should consider something like this. But I don't... You know, I really think he did not lose sleep over having dropped the bombs on Japan, but I don't think he wanted to do it again. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
Might it have been a constitutional issue for him? I mean, during World War II, he was the president, so ordering this was one thing, but might he have thought, well, hey, you know, I'd have to declare war through Congress in order to take this to that level?
That's a good question. I had never read him writing anything about that or saying anything about that, but that's a good question. Yes?
How conscious do you think Truman and the fellows of his regime were that they were stepping into the shoes of the British Empire, and how did he view imperialism?
Right. He was against imperialism. No on imperialism. But he was very conscious that we were taking over Britain's role in key respects. And part of why, I mean, he has the Truman Doctrine. The Truman Doctrine comes together fairly quickly, right, the preparations for it. But it's because he's been thinking about it for quite some time. You know, it's February 1947 that the British come and they say, we can't, you know, we just cannot take care of this region anymore. We don't have the wherewithal to do it. We don't have the power to do it anymore. And Truman's giving that speech in March. I mean, you know, that's really quick. Really quick. If you want to look at a case study for students, this whole thing with the Truman Doctrine, to be able to come up with, you know, a major policy in that quick of fashion, to go through the writing of the speeches, he cleared his calendar for several days. I mean, you know, unprecedented kinds of things for unprecedented policy. So he was very clear. And I think also if you look at how he used Churchill in 1946, that he was also clear in that you know, Truman wasn't condoning imperialism. He didn't want to take on that mantle, but he knew that there was something that the United States was taking over here in terms of defending the West and defending the free world. And so when you have Churchill come to Fulton, Missouri, Truman handwrites an invitation on the invitation, you know, please come, this isn't my home state, I want you to come. You know, people talk about, was he disassociating himself or not? The point is, he was up on the stage. He had Churchill on the train with him on the way to Fulton. This was when they really got to know each other personally in a way that they couldn't when they were at the Potsdam Conference. Churchill's not even, you know, prime minister anymore, but he's Churchill, right? And so Truman knows what he's doing, right? I think that a lot of those around him also understood that this was something that, you know, Marshall and Acheson, those sorts of people could understand too. Yes.
I think that goes back to the point you made about differentiating among states. That is, the British Empire was bad, but the Nazi Empire was worse, the Soviet Empire worse. American Empire would not be would not be good to have an American empire, but even so, it would not be as bad. And he also, I'm sure, probably knew that someone's going to step in there. That is, it's not going to be kind of a Wilsonian thing of we set up the international organization, and no one will want to dominate. Everyone will want to be equal and just and kind, because that's just the way people are.
Right.
He didn't fall for that kind of thing.
He didn't. That's good. Thank you. Yes.
I want to ask you something about Palestine, partition of Palestine. And this comes up to modern day because the world, most of the world believes the United States partition of Palestine instead of Israel. If America didn't do anything about Palestine during World War II, would the State of Israel still have been proposed and set up? I mean, that was a British protectorate.
Right, and in the United Nations, there was all sorts of things coming up between mandate, trusteeship,
what role did we play in the establishment of Israel, number one? Number two, why wasn't there a Palestinian state set up at the same time?
There was.
Well, there was.
Yeah, there was.
Well, why didn't it hold then?
Because the Arab countries immediately attacked.
You have your war right away in 1948.
Yeah. Right.
But if you want to pinpoint on, what did America have to do with it, by this point, the United States is the most powerful country in the world. Everybody's looking at it. It's clear already that the UN isn't operating the way the UN was intended to. And if you hadn't had it, it would have made a big difference.
I think what I'm asking is, the President of Iran stated explicitly that the United States set up Israel. Is that in any way, shape, or form an accurate statement?
I'd say yeah.
No. It was on its way before World War
right.
II.
The question is,
not
does
there,
it
because yeah. Zionist, yeah. not necessarily there.
Yeah, it was there. No, it was there.
But the question is, does it survive without American recognition?
Right.
The state was going to exist. We didn't create it. The question is, could it have survived if we didn't recognize it?
I don't know if it would have existed, though. I'd have to debate that. In that, the Balfour Declaration being cited, well, we're all familiar with Lawrence of Arabia. The Arabs were also promised the same land, so the British had already set up this conundrum. But, as this brings me back to the imperialism statement, though. When you asked Mark about the religious belief, was Truman a... Okay, I didn't think so. But apparently his religious beliefs trumped his belief.
He wrote disparagingly about people who were literalist.
Right.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that.
Humorously.
But apparently his religious beliefs trumped his feelings against imperialism, because obviously all the Arab countries thought that this was an imperialist move.
I think humanitarian too. I also think he thought there was potential for democracy in Israel in a way that he wasn't seeing already in the Arab world. Yes.
Coming back to the nuclear issue, the atomic issue, what was the perception of Truman by the Roosevelt administration that he was kept so much in the dark about the bomb's development?
Right. Yeah. Truman came close to uncovering, when he was head of the Truman Committee, he was even asking about two of the three different places where they were doing some of the experiments for the, the sort of East Coast experiments. Why is all this money being spent? What's going on here? That kind of thing. Remember how he was into saving money, making more efficient, save lives, save money, win World War II, that kind of thing. So he was told in very broad terms, hey, there's something extremely important going on. There's a reason why we're doing this. Please back off. And that was at the personal behest of Roosevelt during World War II. So he did back off. Then he becomes president, and they sort of tell him, we have something to tell you. And it's about that thing from earlier in the war. But he doesn't have the full sit-down until later in April. You know, he becomes president on April 12, 45, and it's not until 2 weeks later, roughly, that he's told everything. Okay, why? Franklin Roosevelt, I don't think he trusted anybody outside his intimate circle. I think he was also dying and sick. And, you know, if you've ever read, have you ever read Robert Farrell's little book on the dying president? That's great, you know. That really shows health matters when it comes to, well, to everything, of course, but, you know, to being president, especially during a war. So I think there was that going on. And also, he thought Truman, you know, Truman was the compromise candidate and all this stuff, but he wasn't necessarily his first choice. He didn't think he was horrible or, you know, totally inadequate, but I think Roosevelt thought he'd still be around. I think he really thought he'd still be alive. He'd be the one in charge and all of that. So I don't know that it was some big conspiracy to hide it from Truman, but he didn't tell him. And also there's, I mean, you know, as you all know, there are different relationships between presidents and vice presidents. And it's in the more modern era where we've had some presidents who have tried to make their vice presidents have more substance, right? Have more to do. Okay, you're not just presiding over the Senate, that's important, but do these other things and have this portfolio, so to speak. And that wasn't, in that period of time, that was not the way vice presidents were looked upon. So you have that too. Yes, back here.
Can you comment on Truman's the sense of accountability of his decision? I've always been impressed with the fact that, you know, he had that, said the buck stops here, and he, no matter what decision, if it was good or if it turned out not so good, he took that sense of accountability. Does that come from his religious background or his being practical or?
Right. It's a great question. I think it comes from all of it. I think, again, you can't necessarily parse out things because we all have our, you know, our inborn temperaments and personalities, and then they grow and develop over time. And, you know, that was his package, so to speak. But, yes, I think being honest, being a straight shooter, we should probably talk more about religion in, you know, again, in the second session, but... I will share with you now, we can come back to it and talk about it more and what it means line by line if you want, but here's his daily prayer. I don't think I have this in the book. Do I have it in the book? Oh, okay. Then it's worth looking at. His daily prayer. I mean, this is something that he started saying from high school on, okay? And, you know, he was still reading the Bible, he was still praying otherwise. But this is what his, you know, when you're in a rough spot and you have to have something that's habituated to fall back on, right? This is what he fell back on daily. He said, "O Almighty and everlasting God, creator of heaven and earth and the universe, help me to be, to think, to act what is right because it is right. Make me truthful, honest, and honorable in all things. Make me intellectually honest for the sake of right and honor and without thought of reward to me. Give me the ability to be charitable, forgiving, and patient with my fellow men. Help me to understand their motives and their shortcomings, even as thou understandest mine. Amen." You know, that's something he didn't stop in the middle of press conferences and say, "Hey, let me tell you about my daily prayer." That's something that, you know, we found after his death and when his longhand notes and things were opened. That's very revealing about him in the context of the question that you raised. Yes? I know you haven't had a chance to ask.
Just how close, much of a toss-up was it between him and William O. Douglas to be vice president?
That one was close in some respects, but I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt was really pushing for Wallace, and there's more evidence that it was really, you know, that would have been, I mean, talk about counterfactual history and
yeah.
Would it have looked different? Oh my. That's the one that a lot of the people who wanted it to be more New Deal, you know, more Roosevelt, they thought that Wallace was the guy. So, I mean, it's, you know, the whole backroom thing at that, there are great books on that. Did you have something on this?
No.
Okay. I think you've been patient.
Yeah, I'd like to get back to the atomic bomb. You said earlier that
you didn't see any writing where Truman contemplated using it again, but I'm curious to take it from the other side. Any records coming out of the Soviet Union in that immediate post-war time as the Soviets are breaking the agreements, did they ever say, well, gee, if we do this, might they drop the bomb on us?
That's a good question. I've read a lot of the translated archival materials, and I don't know if I've read specific mention of that. I mean, they always talked about how the United States had it, and that was part of the reason why they were doing the espionage, to get information and then to go ahead and to test their atomic bomb as quickly as possible and move on and on and on. Maybe they just assumed he might, depending on the circumstances.
Just wondering how much of a deterrent it actually was.
I don't think Truman looked at it in terms of deterrence and the way that deterrence came to be, you know, and when you're talking about 1950s, 1960s deterrence, it's a much different understanding of it. It's like, okay, this is, I mean, he wrote about it, you know, this is an incredible, scary weapon that can change history. And it did, I mean, obviously, with respect to World War II. But I think for him, it was not so much the deterrent. It was okay. Now we know. You know, he knew about some of the espionage. It was disclosed to him earlier than the public knew. He said, "Well, we know they're on the road to getting it, so we can't stop our own research and development." It was more that kind of response. I think we have time for maybe one more question or so before. Can you ask something yet?
No.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you could make any more comment on Truman's relationship with Churchill, with Churchill being very big on the Anglo-American connection and all,
right.
The fear of the atom bomb and that, but yeah, at the same time, you know, the imperialism problem.
Yeah.
I mean, is their relationship more personality driven than their buddies, or is it more of an intellectual connection?
Initially, Churchill really wanted to like Truman. He wanted to, you know, when they meet at Potsdam, and he's so disappointed that that Truman doesn't respond in kind, right? Because, you know, Truman parachuting in, having to deal with both Churchill and Stalin and everything else, he stands back a bit. So they don't get off to the best of starts, right? Then Churchill is, you know, rejected essentially from the premiership, and he, you know, he's still very concerned about what's going on in world politics, right? And so you have the whole, as I said, the whole invitation for the Fulton address, but Churchill comes over early to the States. And he spends some time in Florida, and he's drafting his speech, and he keeps asking, you know, I want to meet with Truman. And Truman, you know, it's a combination of a lot's going on domestically. He's got other obligations. But also there is some reluctance, perhaps, on his part, because now Churchill's out of power. You know, he's trying to maintain relations with the new government, all this sort of stuff. But he sends very close intimates. He doesn't just send anybody down there. He sends very high-up people to talk with Churchill. I think that trip to Fulton, when they're on the train, is really significant. Popular things have been written on it. Scholarly things have been written on it. Everybody always will talk about it. Again, for a teaching, you know, tool of the connection between statesmen and personalities, it's a very good case study or example to use. So they get to know each other, right? And they come to realize that, you know, they don't mind lifting a glass together, and they like poker, and they, you know, they bond this way, right, as men, right? And, I mean, this is Churchill. Could you imagine sitting down and bonding with Churchill, right? But Churchill realizes something. You know, he sees that Truman is understanding and starting to understand and expressing what the Cold War is. And Churchill runs with that. I mean, he He is grateful that Truman is president at that time and that it's not somebody else. And he sees Truman's character, and he sees that, you know, you've got this time and this man. And so that is a large reason for him to give the Fulton Address. You know, he wants to give a major address in America. To him, it's significant that it's in Truman's home state, the president's home state, that it has the president's blessing, at least in terms of they travel together. Truman's on the stage with him, helps to introduce him. All of that is really part of their developing relationship. And then they have correspondence, and they have a couple of interactions after then. And it's much warmer. It's much more congenial. It's a real transformation. And in the, I think it's in the conclusion of the book, I present to you this famous, this would be a good way to go into lunch, this famous story about Churchill and Truman. Let me find it.
228.
Thank you. My own students would never do that. Thank you. I mean, you know, they might. I run seminars, so they do have to participate. But, okay, so anyway, they are now, it's January 1952. Truman's presidency is going to end in a year. Churchill's older now. You know, in the second premiership, he's much older. But anyway, they're on the yacht, the presidential yacht, and Churchill tells him how he had held him in low regard. I love this. When we met at Potsdam in 1945, loathe, you're taking the place of Franklin Roosevelt. And then Churchill says, I misjudged you badly. But he makes Truman wait to hear that. And if you read the various accounts, whether it's in the Foreign Relations of the United States, which is sort of the more, you know, detached account of this, or if you read the personal accounts from various people who were there, which of course are more fun to read. They're not always accurate, I suppose, but they are more fun to read. So anyway, apparently Churchill, in this Churchillian way, drew this out and made him wait, you know, I misjudged you badly. He didn't say that right on the heels of, I loathe, you're taking the place. Since that time, you, more than any other man, have saved Western civilization. When the British could no longer hold out in Greece, you and you alone, sir, made the decision that saved that ancient land from communists. You acted in similar fashion with regard to Azerbaijan, when the Soviets tried to take over Iran. Then there was your resolute stand on Trieste and your Marshall Plan, which rescued Western Europe wallowing in the shallows and easy prey to Joseph Stalin's malevolent intentions. Then you established the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance and collective security for those nations against the military machinations of the Soviet Union. Then there was your audacious Berlin airlift, and of course there was Korea. They got to that point, and after Truman was retired, they had another meeting, and it was apparently very warm and very, I mean, you know, friendly. So they ended up having a very good relationship in the end. So why don't we, I know we're a little over now, why don't we take our break for lunch, and then we can...